Night, February 8th, 2016, Jewish History, Part 6. Okay, good evening. Yeah. Everybody always wants to know what happened, you know, like, what there was a program, I don't know if it was a newspaper article, it was a show, one of the shows. Now you know the rest of the story. It's like, you know, when you hear something, you learn it. It was one of the commentaries you saw on one of the, it wasn't 60 Minutes, but one of these type of things. So now you know the rest of the story. So many times when we're learning in history, when we're learning what's going on, and we learn about the Beis Hamikdash, and we learn about Hanukkah, so we get to a point in Hanukkah, we stop at that point. It's like, that's what I know. But what happened afterwards? What happened after everybody finished lighting their candles, they turned around, they walked away? History moved on. You know, there were a couple thousand years between then and now. What happened in that time in between? So, obviously the story of Hanukkah, as we spoke about in depth last week, was evolved around the Hashmonoi family and how they extended out and incorporated 6,000-7,000 other people to join their fight. At this stage where we are up to, the Hashmonaim, under the leadership of Yonasan, who was Yonasan, the son of... not Judah. Matasyahu, thank you. So Yonasan was, he was prevented from asserting their dominion over Yerushalayim. The Hashmonaim could not yet assert dominion over Yerushalayim. And the reason was because there was this constant fear of a Syrian reconquest. You know, the Syrians were still around, they were still in the picture, and nobody wants to put themselves out if they don't know what's going to happen tomorrow morning. So this created a stalemate, a paralyzing stalemate between the Hellenists and the Hashmonaim, and this went on for quite a period of time, and this ended up bringing the spirit of apathy to the people of Yerushalayim and to Judah, because when you spend so much time working on something, and you don't see any result, and you don't see any gain, and you're afraid to go further, because tomorrow morning everything you worked on and you did might be uprooted, it might be cast aside. So at this stage, the rabbis attempted to do what they do best, which is to imbue a sense of spiritual basis of Jewish life, and they wanted to rally the people to get Torah and tradition back into action. But the strong political and social power base of the Hellenists was still there. That had not yet disappeared. And that made many of the initiatives for a stronger Torah life very, very difficult to actualize and to make it happen. And the reason is, without a dominant political and governmental structure which is friendly to the ideals of tradition and Jewish observance, Jewish survival is always at a risk and always jeopardized as to what's going to happen. I don't want to even bring it up to date, but if you think about it, you know, Baruch Hashem, we have Eretz Yisrael, and so many things have happened, but we don't have, it's not like you have a Jewish government in Eretz Yisrael, and even if we do, and any kind of halachic rulings that go on are constantly being battled by other people, and why should they have it, and why should they have the say? When you live in an environment where there's a Sanhedrin, and everybody abides by that, then it's much, much easier to have a Jewish lifestyle and to have Jewish traditions go on. But when the opportunity arises, and anybody can challenge it and knock it out of the park, it's much more serious for that, much more difficult for that to happen. So the opportunity for the Hashmonaim, the opportunity for renewed Hashmonaim dominion presented itself in the year 153 before the Common Era, and this was a product of the Byzantine plot regarding the leadership of Syria. This is very interesting. You know, in Yiddish is an expression that we say, a mensch tracht und Gott lacht, which means a man thinks, he plots, he does what he wants to do, and God does what he wants. God understands better than we understand. And as much as we contemplate and think we're going to do what we do, sometimes events in history are such that something that appears to have nothing to do with the Jewish people, something going on totally independent, has an effect. And the way the Ribbono Shel Olam works is he does everything for the sake of Klal Yisrael. So this is a perfect example of what took place at this period of time. Alexander Balas, he was what I will call a pretender to the throne of Syria, and I say he was a pretender because he rose to challenge the rule of Demetrius. Alexander Balas claimed to be the son of Antiochus IV, and thus legitimate heir of the throne to Syria. He was the heir of the Seleucids, that was his position. I am the son of Antiochus IV. The problem is that he had a tremendous resemblance, tremendous physical resemblance to Antiochus IV, but those who were knowledgeable and people who knew they knew that he was an imposter. And they knew there was no truth to it. So how did he get away with it? He got away with it because there are so many foreign enemies that Syria had at this point that they were very, very willing to jump on the bandwagon with him, and they were willing to support him and say, no, he's the heir, just to push the existing government out of place. And it was led by the Ptolemaic Egyptians were the ones who gave him the most support and the most strength, and they combined with the others, and they put Alexander Balas, and they helped him support his illegitimate claim to the throne. He set up a center in the area called Acre, which we spoke about once before, and he threatened to invade Syria and to depose Demetrius. That's what he's going to do. That's what he said, that's my goal right now. I'm getting Demetrius out. If Demetrius was still the current emperor in charge of Syria, Demetrius is being sent out. Here's what Demetrius did. Demetrius was obviously feeling more and more isolated, and he recognized the greater danger that was coming on with all these people ganging up against him and putting somebody else into power. So he chose to play a very, very interesting card. What he did was he reached out to Yonasan, and he offered him rule and over a fully autonomous Judah in return for support against Alexander Balas. So he cut a deal with Yonasan. And here, once again, we see where they're coming to the Jews and they're saying, okay, obviously you have a strong army. Obviously you have ability. You can do that. Cut a deal. Come on to my side. Yonasan was not a fool. Very, very shrewd. And he acted upon the offer. However, he never, ever officially accepted the offer. He acted on it, but he didn't accept it. What's the difference? The difference is that at this stage, you'll see in a second, Yonasan and the Hashmonaim, they left, I told you last week, they were in a place called Michmash, which was north of Jerusalem. They left there and they moved their home base to Yerushalayim. The Syrian army that was garrisoned in Yerushalayim at this time was withdrawn to return to Syria to help bolster Demetrius' defense against Alexander Balas. So all the people who were in Yerushalayim left. Yonasan came back in, and now he had no Syrians there. Yonasan immediately acted to refortify the city's strong points, to repair all the breaches in the outer city walls. If you remember, they were torn down by Lysias, who we spoke about last week, when he returned to Syria to kill Philip. On his way out, he ripped down all the walls around Yerushalayim. Yonasan took this advantage, took the moment, and he had everything built back up again as quickly as he can. He was a very, very good diplomat, Yonasan. He was very, very shrewd. He was a good judge of people's personalities and characters, and he recognized all the egos involved in the contestants for the Syrian throne. And like I said before, he was no fool, and he didn't want to get caught between on the wrong side of a battle. So this is what I meant when I said that he didn't accept the terms, because at this stage of the game, he sent emissaries to establish a relationship with Alexander Balas as well. So here he has Demetrius coming to him, and now he's going to Alexander Balas to set up delegates to try and make some sort of a deal. While delicately continuing to nurture the association with Demetrius, he didn't let that go, but he sent emissaries to Alexander Balas. That's what we call a Yiddish cup. You have to be careful, because sometimes you play the cards wrong, you can get yourself in double trouble. But he was very shrewd, and he was very fair in the way he approached it. Alexander Balas felt very, very confident about his potential victory over the Seleucid Empire. So what he did was he appointed Yonasan as leader of Judah, and he empowered him to serve as the Kohen Gadol, the high priest in the Beis HaMikdash once again. And Yonasan's appointment to the high priesthood at this stage ended the rule of the Tzadok family, who had been there for so long, that had nothing to do with Yiddishkeit theoretically. And now that he was back in power, he took over the position of the Kohen Gadol once again. Under Yonasan, the land of Judah and the city of Yerushalayim were finally free from Syrian domination. So it turns out that 12 years, it took 12 years from the time of the miracle of Hanukkah for the victory of the Hashmonaim to finally be seen as completed and confirmed by events of history. 12 years from the time they first started their victory until right now they were Syrian free, so to speak, in the Beis HaMikdash. Yonasan chose and eventually committed himself to Alexander Balas. He saw where it was going. He had to make a commitment one way or the other, and he chose to make his alliance with Alexander Balas, and he became one of his very, very valuable allies. The Hellenists did exactly what they always did. The second Yonasan was now in power and he was strong, they went running to Alexander Balas and they said, we want to get rid of Yonason. You know, it's crazy. He's running a real Jewish event up there at the Beis HaMikdash. That's not what we want. But this time around, he didn't put up with it. He didn't take that. He had a deal with Yonason, and he was keeping his deal, and he rebuffed them totally. He did not give them any credence, and he didn't have to worry about the Hellenists for a period of time. So it comes out that after almost two centuries of Greek control, even though that was technically under Syrian control, Judah became, for all practical purposes, an independent state. Alexander Balas was very, very successful in his campaign against Demetrius, eventually not just defeating him, but he even executed him. So he accomplished that which we had set out to do. Alexander Balas, unfortunately, like all these people in power, turned out to be a very, very serious tyrant. He wasn't like this nice guy that everybody thought he was. He was very, very foolish in politics, in diplomacy, and immoral in his personal life. Once again, we see that repeated over and over and over again. His father-in-law, Talmai, who was the Egyptian king, eventually turned against Alexander and supported a new prospect for the Seleucid throne. His own father-in-law wanted to get him pushed out. And the new prospect was Demetrius II. I know it gets confusing with the names being so similar, but Demetrius II was a new prospect that was going to come up now, and they were going to try and get rid of Alexander Balas. He was a son of Demetrius, who was just kicked out of office, and who was killed by Alexander. And Demetrius II not only succeeded in driving Alexander Balas from the throne, but he also married the queen, the daughter of Talmai of Egypt. So now he, Demetrius' son, Demetrius II, took over again and pushed Alexander Balas out of power. Ultimately, Alexander Balas was assassinated in exile in the year 145 before the Common Era. However, as we said before, Alexander was Yonason's main person, he was his main man. Sensing the inherent weakness and instability of the Seleucid kingdom, Yonason now negotiated an agreement with Demetrius II. The new power, new man in charge, we got to try and cut a deal with him. And this accomplished several things. He was very successful with this particular deal. Number one, it gave Judah dominion over an additional three areas of Samaria and the Galilee. The second thing, though, is it significantly reduced the tribute payment to Judah and to Syria. So their financial obligations became seriously reduced. The Judean state was now growing in size, growing in power, and growing in influence. Yonasan was committed to further growth and expansion. He wanted to let this keep going and keep going. He didn't want to be limited to just that small area of Yerushalayim. Demetrius II proved to be no better than and no more popular than his father or even Alexander Balas had been. Again, literally history repeats itself. The second they get into the office, the second they have the opportunity, we see what their true character is. We see what they're really about. Somebody new was on the horizon for the Seleucid throne. His name was Tryphon, a former official of Alexander Balas. Installed himself, the way he got in was, he installed himself as a regent to the infant son of Alexander Balas. So since he was in charge of the son was the heir to the throne, supposedly. So now he got his people following him, he had his support, and he was now going to become the true center of power. He became a very strong center of power in Syria. Yonason exploited the insecurities of the new Seleucid rulers, and he obtained from Tryphon decrees confirming the following. All of the advantageous arrangements that he was granted by the Hasmonaim, to the Hasmonaim by Demetrius I, he got all of the things that were granted to him by Alexander Balas. He got everything that was granted to him by Demetrius II. Everything he got from what's his name? Thank you, Tryphus. I went blank for a second. He got everything he was looking for. Yonason also furthered his goal of conquering over the land of Israel by then occupying the southern coast of Israel, including the Greek cities of Ashkelon and Gaza, as well as the remainder of the Galilee. Ashkelon would soon revert back to Greek rule, but at the moment, this was there. Thus, Yonason was now within reach of the Hasmonaim's goal of restoring all of the land of Israel to the Jewish rule for the first time in the life of the Second Commonwealth. Albeit close at hand, Yonason would never ever live to see the fulfillment of his dream. Why? As we mentioned, the Tryphon was the new leader in the Seleucid world, and as a result of all the turmoil in Syria, The same turmoil somewhat destabilized the Hashmonaim rule and the Hashmonaim power, because the Jews were never certain who to make a deal with. We just saw in the past 5 minutes of talking that it keeps going back and forth. Every time they cut a deal, they think they're ahead, they think they're losing. It just creates a sense of confusion and therefore discomfort. And they don't know who to trust, and they don't know who to negotiate with. They got tired of seemingly endless war with Syria, and they were hoping for a Syrian leader that would be strong enough and good enough to fashion a long-lasting peace agreement with the Hashmonaim and with the Jewish people. The Hashmonaim hoped that Tryphon would be that leader. Unfortunately, they were mistaken. Tryphon pretended to show peace and leadership towards Judah. In actuality, he was raising a great army and intending to invade the Jewish state. He was overconfident, and he overestimated Yonasan. He overestimated Yonasan's determination, overestimated Yonasan's willpower.
He overestimated
his own abilities, and he underestimated Yonasan's determination, correct. Tryphon marched across the northern Jordan River, and he got as far as Beit Shan, which is south of Tveria. And there he was stymied by the Hashmonaim army. They were waiting for him, they were ready, and they called the advance, put it to a halt. Okay, so now Tryphon's no fool. What he did was, he immediately declared his intention of establishing a permanent peace relationship with Judah. I'm coming here to establish a peace relationship with you. That's why I'm on my way in. He invited Yonasan to confirm with him regarding the terms of the treaty. The place for the treaty was set to be Acre, which was then under Tryphon's control. Naively, unfortunately, Yonasan accepted Tryphon's assurance that this was going to be a safe and peaceful meeting. When he arrived to Acre, Yonasan was immediately arrested, and he was held hostage for a ridiculously large ransom. Shimon, who was Yonasan's last surviving Hashmonai brother, he agreed to pay the ransom. Tryphon nonetheless killed Yonasan, and he sent Shimon only Yonasan's remains in exchange for the ransom money, which he collected. You can imagine that this act of deceit, this act of cruelty, this act of treachery was what ultimately guaranteed that the Hashmonaim's war against Syria was not over and would indeed continue for a period of time. So all their hopes in putting it into Tryphon fell apart. I don't need to tell you that Shimon was angry. I mean, you can imagine paying the ransom, gathering the money, and getting your brother back in a box. Shimon waged and fought a very, very skilled and political war against Tryphon. Very unusual heavy winter snows interfered with the progress of Tryphon's armies. Unusual amounts of snow that came down. Again, when we leave things to God, he operates the way he wants to. This is what took place. When you combine that together with the relentless harassment by the Hashmonaim army, the Syrians were finally forced to withdraw from the Judean soil. That's it. Between the snow, between the army fighting them back, they also just backed out once again, and they left. Shimon entered into an alliance with Demetrius II, Tryphon's enemy and rival, who was now rising to power in Syria. The new circumstances of Syria forced a change in its traditional hatred towards the Jews, towards Judah in general. The small Jewish commonwealth was now freed completely from taxes and tribute to Syria whatsoever. And Shimon was able to achieve that which had eluded all of his Hashmonaim brothers prior to him: true independence and sovereignty for Judah. Shimon was the one who actually made that a reality. Shimon declared himself the Nasi, prince, president, and minted Hebrew coins to commemorate the new independence of the state of Judah. Totally free. Shimon refused to call himself king. Why? Because he didn't come from the tribe of Judah, and he understood that only people coming from the tribe of Yehuda can be king. He was a Kohen, he was not a king, and he was not a descendant from the house of Judah. Shimon consolidated Yonasan's capture of Jaffa, which was very, very important, as we mentioned the other day, because of the ports that they had there. The road to Jerusalem from the coast was completely secured. The Hashmonaim now occupied the fortress of Acre in Jerusalem, which had been the stronghold of the Hellenists and the Syrians up until this point. In a last desperate attempt to ignore history and all of its consequences, Antiochus VII was the successor of Demetrius II, attempting one last battle to conquer Judah in the year 137 before the Common Era. Shimon defeated the Syrians near the town of Yavne, and a new era of peace, prosperity, and spiritual renewal began in Judah. They were, Baruch Hashem, we would say, free for now. As we've said many, many times, nobody can harm us as badly as we can harm ourselves. That's unfortunately the way history always shows us. The Hasmonaim dynasty would eventually do to itself and to Judah what the hated Greeks and Syrians could not do. The independence of the Jewish state and its remarkable opportunity for physical and spiritual growth and tranquility would go largely unexploited due to the human frailty and internal conflicts and disputes, internal machlaikas, internal fights, Jew to Jew, person to person. Instability would now work its way into Jewish life, both the public and private, that would eventually sap the vitality of the population and allow Judah to become conquered and subjugated once again. The dispute... Did who?
Shimon.
Shimon was the Kohen Gadol. Yeah, he took over from when he became Kohen, he took over the position. But the disputes that erupted regarding temporal power and control would spill over into the religious world of Jewry as well. It would continue to be machlokes. Hatred of other Jews became an accepted social norm. And this would eventually poison Jewish society and lead to the destruction of the Jewish state and to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Anybody who knows, whenever we have Tisha B'Av and we learn the Gemara, what ultimately destroyed the second Beis HaMikdash was what we call Senas Chinam, hatred of one to another. It's much complicated than that, but this is on the surface. The basis of destruction is internal hatred. Rabbi Beryl Wine once asked the following question. He says, you know, if you look in the parashas a couple weeks ago, Yisro goes over to Moshe, and Yisro says to him, Moshe, the way you're doing this is wrong. You need to set up, you know, you're one judge over all these people. It's much too much, right? Set up, sorry, Meir, sorry, Alofim, sorry. Set up groups and let the people have hard questions. Machlokes, small arguments come to you, then the more difficult. And ultimately, the ones that can't be settled, they'll come to you. So Rabbi Beryl Wine asks, he goes, I understand something. They just left Egypt. How many commandments did they already get at Hasina? They just got a couple of commandments. What was all this fighting about? 600,000 people, what's all this arguments about that you had to have so many courts? How long? A couple weeks into the system. So much arguing, so much fighting going on, you have to have more courts in Israel so Moshe can handle it. Too much, set up hundreds of thousands, set up it. And in his inevitable style, Rabbi Wein said, quote, you put two Jews together, you're going to have a fight? This is what took place once again. You put two Jews together, you're going to have a machlokes, you're going to have a fight, and if they don't have a strong enough support from the spiritual end and from the learning end, then there's nothing to offset that, and ultimately it causes a downfall. Shimon's successes would begin to wither almost immediately as family friction, sibling jealousies, and foolish and irresponsible behavior took control of events. Listen to this. Shimon's sons, Yochanan, Hyrcanus, Yehuda, and Matthisiah, and they had a brother-in-law named Talmai ben Chovav. We're just going to say Talmai, so, but you know I'm talking about Talmai ben Chovav. He was the husband of Shimon's oldest daughter. All jockeyed for positions, for power, even while Shimon was still ruling, they were already jockeying for position for power. While Shimon's sons remained at least publicly loyal to the father's rule, he didn't, you know, father's still my father, he's still in charge. Talmai was much more cruel and much more evil. The brother-in-law was much more evil. As a wedding gift to his son-in-law, Shimon had given Talmai the position to be the ruler over Jericho. Mazel tov, you got married, here's Jericho, have a city, enjoy. That's going to be, you're in charge. He wasn't happy with that. He wanted to be the sole ruler over all of Judah. He wasn't happy. He was very insulted that his father-in-law only gave him Jericho to be in charge of. He entered into secret negotiations with Antiochus VII, who was still feeling the emotional pangs and pains of his own defeat by Shimon at Yavne that we spoke about. Talmai accepted to secure his role as the future ruler of Judah. He promised cooperation to Antiochus for his new campaign to reconquer Jerusalem. Judah. He made a deal with Antiochus. You reconquer Judah, I'll help you, but ultimately I want my position. Antiochus committed himself to invading Judah and taking Yerushalayim, while Talmai undertook to assassinate his father-in-law and his brothers-in-law. That was his end of the bargain. Shimon, unaware of the treachery surrounding him, innocently accepted Talmai's invitation to attend an elaborate family banquet which took place at Talmai's palace in Jericho. He had Jericho, that was his town. He had a palace, he invited him for a party. Come, we have a big simcha. And Shimon came, he had no idea what Talmai was up to, his son-in-law. Yehuda Matisyo, who was Shimon's sons, they accompanied their father to Jericho for the trip. When they arrived there, the mercenary guards of Talmai attacked them and literally hacked them to death. Shimon, the last of the original Chashmonaim, met with the same violent death that all of his brothers did. This is an inexplicable family tragedy that happened to the entire Chashmonaim family. As a matter of fact, there seems to have been a black cloud of death, so to speak, overhanging the entire Chashmonaim family from the very, very beginning, one after another. I'm not talking about the masses of the people, I'm talking about the family itself. Many Jewish philosophers would contemplate as to why this happened over the course of many years. To such a heroic family, why this took place. The Ramban, in his commentary on Bereishis, he brings an incisive view of the spiritual pitfalls that befell the family based on, if you remember last week I told you, Yehuda, his well-intentioned yet disastrous plan that we spoke about last week, when he entered into a treaty with Rome without first taking counsel with the rabbis and with the rabbinate. And the Ramban goes into an entire explanation, which we're not going to go into and I haven't even read through in detail, but he goes through an entire explanation about how this was one of the steps that caused such disastrous outcome for the Chashmonaim family. Shimon's wife, Talmai's mother-in-law, was taken hostage and held in Talmai's fortress. Now, even though he did not accompany his father to Yericho, Yochanan Hyrcanus, he was still marked for death by Talmai. However, he discovered the plot and he managed to kill the plotters before they got to him. And in the year 135 BCE, he proclaimed himself a successor to his father Shimon, the new Nasi of Yehuda. He immediately arrived in Jerusalem to consolidate and hold the consolidate the government of Judah. Now the saga of the Chashmonaim in the Commonwealth of Judah now entered into a new era. Yochanan Hyrcanus immediately embarked on the first of many, many unfortunate civil wars that would stain the Chashmonaim rule. He raised a large force and he proceeded to lay siege on Talmai with all of his forces. He went to Jericho, he surrounded Jericho, he laid siege on Talmai and his forces who had taken refuge to Jericho. Talmai was now faced with one of two things: starvation, because, you know, when you surrounded a city like Jericho, you couldn't get out, you couldn't bring in food. You have two options. Either you stay inside and you starve, or you come out and you get captured. Those were the two things he was faced with. So he played what we call his refuge card. What he did was he exhibited Yochanan's mother from the parapets of the fortress. He put her up on top, where she can be seen on a daily basis, mocking and insulting the family of Shimon. There were days when Talmai had ordered that she receive public beatings in full sight and earshot of her son, Yochanan. She, to her credit, begged her son not to succumb to the blackmail and to continue the siege. She knew that if you give in, we're in trouble. Withstand it, don't worry about me. You're doing the right thing. However, other factors intervened to upset Yochanan's campaign. Antiochus VII, who was true to his evil bargain, he moved on Yerushalayim. He started a march towards Yerushalayim. Yochanan Hyrcanus was forced to end the siege at Jericho, so that he can redeploy his forces and protect the capital of Judah, which is Yerushalayim. Talmai, in his final fit of vindictive cruelty, and this is like so hard to contemplate, he killed his mother-in-law and he fled across the Jordan, never again to be heard of in Jewish life. That was his last act. He killed his mother-in-law and he disappeared. Yochanan Hyrcanus had a very, very hard time trying to repulse the invasion of Antiochus VII. In a year-long war that lasted from the year 135 BCE to 134 BCE, he exhausted the Jewish army, and yet no decisive result was gained. There's only so much you can take without seeing results. Yochanan was forced to agree to a humiliating truce and what he gave into in order just to stop people from being killed, in order to be able to get some groundwork and to accomplish something, was, under the terms of the truce, much of the defensive wall of Yerushalayim was again torn down. Jewish hostages were taken as guarantors for the payment of continuing taxes to Syria, once again, and an initial one-time punitive tax payment of 500 talents of silver were extracted from Yochanan's treasury. But once again, Yad Hashem, God intervened, and made itself visible of support of the Hashmonaim leader. In the year 129 BCE, riots and mutinies swept across Syria. Antiochus VII, having just completed a successful campaign against Partha, was surprised by the attacks, and he was deposed by his enemies. So he was now out of position. Antiochus VII is out of luck. As a point of interest, just so that you know, many, many Jewish soldiers fought on behalf of Antiochus VII. There were so many Jews in his army that he avoided any hostilities on Shabbos. He avoided any type of serious wars or fights on Shavuos. I don't know why specifically Shavuos or anything else, in order to appease the Jewish soldiers who did not want to fight for him on Shabbos, did not want to fight for him on Shavuos. That's how many people he had fighting for him in his army. Forced, desired, that I can't tell you, but that's what was going on. Total chaos now was throughout Syria. And with it, the century-long desire by Syria to control Judah finally came to a failed end. That's over. Yochanan, smart as he was, quickly took advantage of the change of the situation in Syria. He rebuilt the walls once again around Yerushalayim. You have to go to Yerushalayim and you see the walls around the Beis HaMikdash, you see the walls around the city. There's so many different layers and so many different, they say this is from this period, this is from that period. If you hear the amount of times these walls came up and went down, it's not surprising that there was so much work that was involved. He negotiated the return of the Jewish hostages that were held previously by Antiochus VII, and he discontinued the payment of tribute to Syria. He regained a level of Jewish independence first achieved years earlier by his father, Shimon. The Hashmonaim dynasty was now on the verge of attaining diplomatic and popular success and territorial security. Yochanan Hyrcanus prepared to change roles from being the defender of a small, beleaguered country to conqueror of a neighboring land surrounding Judah. He wanted to expand. The area of Judah was limited since it was founded by Ezra to the vicinity of Yerushalayim and the land southeast of it. However, under previous Hashmonaim rule, some areas of the Mediterranean coast, basically from Ashkelon to Jaffa, were also annexed to Judah and were pieces, as were pieces of the Galilee. Yochanan Hyrcanus longed to restore the Jewish commonwealth to its biblical borders. That was his desire and his goal. He moved his army, commanded now by his two sons, Yehuda, Aristobulus, and Antigonus, to north of Jerusalem, capturing the Samaritan stronghold of Shomron and destroying the Samaritan temple on Mount Gerizim near Shechem. He also moved his forces east of the Jordan River, conquering large sections of Transjordan and expanding the Hashmonaim rule over those lands as well. He then turned his attention to the southern part of the land of Israel. He struck out at the Idumeans in their Negev home, and after conquering them, forced them to convert to Judaism. This was a fatal error, by the way, because it's going to come back to haunt them later on. And once again, the opposition of the rabbis always opposed anybody being forced into conversion to Judaism. Ultimately, it comes back to bite you big time. But when viewed alongside his continuing successes, the matter was glossed over only to rise and destroy Yochanan's successors two generations later. The Idumeans provided fierce warriors and diplomats to the service of the Hashmonaim king. They supported him now. He conquered them. They gave him their diplomats. They gave him their soldiers, who came to rely upon them more and more during his reign. Consolidating his gains, Yochanan Hyrcanus conquered the Lower Galilee and the Valley of Jezreel. The Hashmonaim Empire now stretched nearly to the promised biblical borders of Israel, from Dan to Beersheba, and from Transjordan and the Golan to the Mediterranean. That was now totally under Judean rule. He also strongly fortified Jerusalem, rebuilding its walls and reinforcing the ramparts around the Beis HaMikdash and the Temple Mount. Yochanan Hyrcanus thus became one of the great warrior kings in Jewish history, and under his rule, the Jewish Commonwealth was strong, prosperous, and seemingly secure for the first time since the Jewish return from Babylonia over two centuries earlier.
What year was that, 130?
130, 134, somewhere. Again, we always have this 20-year lead that I always discuss with you, but it's within that. Unfortunately, Jews always suffer good fortune poorly, meaning the last years of the reign of Yochanan Hyrcanus were clouded with communal and religious dissension within the Jewish society. The discredited Hellenists disappeared from the scene, but new forces rose up to take their cause and to disrupt Jewish traditional life. Hellenists were gone, but there was somebody new on the horizon. Who? The old aristocracy of the priesthood, who were originally shunted aside by the Hashmonaim and their allies among the Kohanim, joined forces with the Sadducees in opposition of the Hashmonaim and their rabbinic Pharisee allies. So that a new group coming to challenge, the Pharisees are coming to challenge. The Sadducees now openly denied, this was Sadducim is what we call them in Hebrew, the Sadducees, they openly denied the validity of oral law. They just came right out with it. Oral laws, Narishkeit, doesn't mean a thing. And they refused to accept upon themselves the decrees, interpretations, attitudes, and authority of the leading Pharisee rabbis. So you had the rabbis in place, but the Sadducees, the Sadducim, refused to accept any of that upon themselves.
Did they accept the written law?
They accepted the written law, but you'll see in about a half a second that the Sadducees held the lower economic class of Jews in contempt. They mocked their loyalty to Jewish tradition and custom. So even if somebody was doing something, they would make fun of them constantly. Who are you doing? You're too religious. You've heard that before, right? You're being too frum. What do you have to be so frum for? They interpreted the Torah according to their own spirit and their own whim. So even though they believed in the Old Testament, so to speak, but their interpretation of it. And they would interpret things the way it worked. And sometimes that was easier, sometimes that was harder. At times, prohibiting that which traditional Judaism allows. The best example of that was not allowing a person to eat hot food on Shabbos. They took a position that, according to oral law, you're allowed to have, you know, you're not allowed to cook on Shabbos. You're not allowed to make fire on Shabbos. So the way they translated was, you're not allowed to have fire going on Shabbos. So oral law says that if the fire is going before Shabbos, if you cook it before Shabbos the way we do, it's not a problem. They said, no, doesn't exist. You're not allowed to eat anything hot Shabbos morning. One of the reasons that to this day we eat chont, or some sort of a hot dish on Shabbos morning, was because the rabbis instituted to specifically eat hot food Shabbos morning to show against the Sadducim, to show against the Sadducees, and to disprove what they were doing. One of the easiest stands they can take against them was to say, it's a mitzvah, you have to eat something hot Shabbos morning. And that was the invention of chont, that's where it came from. Even though some people say the word chont comes from shul ende, you know, when the shul's over. That doesn't go for the Kiddush Club because you're running in early. But the Shul Emda, so that's like, you know, so that's what they say. It comes different versions of where the word chont came from. But the concept of it was, and that's what the mitzvah is, to eat something hot Shabbos morning to prove that within the guidelines of the law, you're allowed to. They obviously were much more lenient in many, many situations as well. They were not acknowledging the Torah Shabbat whatsoever. In order to be more attractive, you need to offer laxity in ritual observance, which is what they did. Everybody's attracted to something easier. Don't make it so tough. Don't make it so... Who says it has to be so hard? And if you get made fun of for doing something more strictly, then of course you're going to want to run and be part of the Sadducim. Though they were not pagan, as were the Hellenists, the Sadducees nevertheless inherited the Hellenist disdain for Torah, tradition, and less sophisticated Jews. That's it. If you were less sophisticated than me, you're not a besser mensch, you're not as intelligent as I am, you don't see the new coming of the, you don't see the new direction and the new way, you know, you're not going to be part of my group. You can't come to me for lunch. They encourage a life of hedonism and the pursuit of luxury and pleasure to the exclusion of the traditional lifestyle and value system. In their haughtiness, they separated themselves from the Jewish masses. And in their inability to appreciate and believe in the oral law, in the Torah Shabbat Peh, they created a frozen, non-flexible, and uncaring Judaism. Ultimately, without the Torah there, the feeling and the emotion is gone as well. It just becomes very harder rules, easier rules, but everything becomes very, very rigid with no flexibility. That eventually deteriorated into empty, pompous ceremonies and adaptations of Greek and Roman cultures. When you have a ceremony that has no feeling behind it, when you're running a yontif and there's no simcha behind it, you're just doing the rules because it's a rule and there's no feeling, even in this day and age, that's one of the big problems. I always say, forgive me, but I say it about people who become Baal Tshuva, which is a beautiful thing when a person becomes a Baal Tshuva. But he has to learn some of the feeling and the emotion that goes into it too. It's not enough to just do it because you have to do it, because you can do that for a while. And even if you're strong enough to maintain that, your kids won't. Because your kids don't see any love behind it. They don't see any emotion or feeling behind it. And this is what happened to them as well. It was too rigid without the emotion, without the feeling. So like I said, and this is what I ended with for this week, basically, if you do not have Torah to guide your direction, eventually you will rationalize everything and anything. This is no different today, as I just mentioned. That's why we believe in both Torah fi Sinai. That's why we believe in the original Testament. This is where we've gone up to. The Jews are free. The Tzedakim are in place. Next week, by the way, very important, we're not going to have a class here. I encourage everybody to sign up, to call and to sign up for the talk that's going to be taking place at Anshei Emunah from APAC. And it's a Dr. Kedar. I've read some of his work. I've seen some of his stuff. My brother's the one who turned me on to him in the first place. I was going to have him come down here. He felt it was a conflict of interest because he's already speaking for APAC in Delray Beach. So I said, can we combine venues? He said, absolutely. So they gave me the information and the number for us to go over there. There's no charge, and there's even some coffee and, you know, cake and something.
But you have to register. So
you must register. The phone number's on there. This seems to be a confusion of time. Even though our time says that it's at 7 o'clock, Arthur says that he got a email confirmation back confirming 5 o'clock. So that's that. No, I don't know that to be true. And I know it's true that he says he got that. I'm gonna verify right now, even at 7. The information that we published in the bulletin is an exact cut and paste of what I got from APAC. So that should be accurate. I don't anticipate there being any changes. I will verify it. If there is some sort of a change, we'll send out a notice, we'll send out information, we'll announce a Shabbos, we'll make sure that everybody gets to know. Okay? Yeah. Thank you very much.
Great.